The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Dan Thomas. Coming up on today's show, Matteo Bonetti will be here to talk about Zlatan's brace in AC Milan's opening win. We'll also be hearing from Sid and get the reaction from Spain to Real Madrid's poor 0-0 draw against Real Sociedad. We'll start, though, in the Premier League. And Manchester City kicking off their campaign today with a 3-1 victory away against Wolves. Here to break it down with me, Don, Frank and Craig. Craig, let's start with you. That was some first-half performance from City. You kind of thought, well, game's over. But in the end, they are made to work for it.
Well, that's what City do, isn't it, at the moment? And you know, they're clearly... You know, they need a big leader at the back. They've brought Aki in, but, you know, John Stones is back in there fit. But, you know, I don't think he's going to be filling any of the City fans or his manager full of confidence. He didn't have a terrible game, but it's just every time the ball drops there, you think he's going to be hesitant or he's going to make a mistake. And, you know, I do think they need that Vincent Kompany leadership. They need a presence there that's really marshalling the back line. But that apart, they were absolutely superb. When you think that's them out of the blocks for their first game, so they're a little rusty. They have a raft of injuries as well. Not that anybody would feel sorry for City, but they do. Gundogan, Bernardo Silva, amongst those out, Riyad Mahrez. So when you put it all on the plate and they were at Wolves away, they're a good side. They didn't have some of their new signings as well, but it was pretty impressive. And Phil Foden again in that first 45. Really, really impressive.
This is a fixture that City, of course, lost last year, Don. You look at that, and let's focus on that for the first 45 minutes, shall we, where they were just brilliant.
They were. They were sensational. And it was a statement win because even without kicking a ball, Liverpool winning two games were under pressure. And this fixture's not been kind to Man City. So the first 45, Dan, I thought they were brilliant. They knocked the ball around. I thought De Bruyne was on another level. Phil Foden got his goal. The two holding midfield players I thought was a good pick from Pep, just trying to screen his centre-halves. I think Fernandinho done well with the ball at his feet and Rodri doesn't waste too many passes. So when you watch them in that first 45 minutes when the passing was slick and they moved it one and two touch, the Wolves players in the first 45 couldn't get anywhere near them.
But then the second 45, Frank, was where there was that vulnerability. And as Craig mentioned, at the back, there's something about City, like every time a team goes forward, you always feel they're going to have a chance.
Yeah, that's the main problem for City. It's been the case, you know, for so many years, let's say, because of the problem that Craig just mentioned. They're defensively, they're not strong enough. So, yeah, you lead 2-0, you feel that the game is in your hand, and suddenly you have one attack from the Wolves, and then you start having some question marks about how you're going to defend, and then it increases, and more and more you wonder until you concede a goal, and then you start shaking, and it's becoming a nightmare. So that's the main problem that City has. They had a fantastic first 45 minutes, but as soon as they are under pressure, as soon as they wonder how their football has gone, they have a problem. And it was the case. They should have been prepared for that because, of course, it would have a reaction from the Wolves. But at the end of the day, we still have the same problem that we had last season, meaning they have to resolve the defensive problem that they're facing.
And what if they can't bring in new personnel, Craig? How do they fix it? Is it fixable?
Yeah. And, you know, I think, as Don mentioned, the two guys screening is a start. Two very good defensive midfielders, two brilliantly defensive midfielders in Rodri and Fernandinho. Fernandinho still looks as fit as a fiddle in his mid-30s. It's quite incredible. But I'm not the biggest fan. I've got to say, I'm not the biggest fan of Benjamin Mendy. Walker's pace gets him out of trouble sometimes, and his defending today was excellent. And one of the things they might have to look at is Ederson's starting position. And maybe he's going to have a starting position if this continues as it did last season, if this continues as a theme for them, he's going to maybe have to play more of a Manuel Neuer role, and he's going to have a really high starting position and take chances for those balls that go over the top that he can come and mop them up, because we know he's good enough with his feet. Mm. And we've seen Neuer do it so many times with Bayern Munich playing a high line, and yeah, he makes the odd mistake, but he quite often comes up out there as the sweeper-keeper. And I think if they don't bring in a Koulibaly or a big presence at the back, it's certainly something that Guardiola and Ederson are going to have to think about, his starting position being higher up and further outside the box.
Frank, from a defensive perspective, how do you deal with someone like Kevin De Bruyne, who was once again brilliant today?
It's very hard because the problem, you have to talk to your midfielders first, you know, that they have to do the job, that they have to try to stop him before he gets the ball. And after, when he faces you and you know that he's going to deliver a fantastic assist, most of the time it's what it is, you will have to compensate and work all together to... let's say, to cover each other the best you can, to make sure that you're not going to allow him to put a ball between you and one of your teammates. That's the main concern. But you have to work on that. I mean, that's a possible thing that you can do. It's start running backwards first. Be prepared to go fast behind you, because it's where the ball is going to go. And maybe you're going to resolve something. But that's always the problem that you have when you face fantastic worldwide players. Yeah. Is you're not going to resolve everything. You're going to have to pray at some point to think that you are fortunate, and maybe you're going to be successful.
This is making me laugh, Dan, because FIFA and UEFA and all the governing bodies did brilliantly with some of the law changes that protects the super talented players. Not protects them, but allows them to showcase their talents more, because the boys will know, back in the sort of mid to late 90s, or maybe just before that, I've had managers telling me, get longer studs in my boots and get out there and absolutely smash him in the first minute. Kill him, smash him, two-foot him, all that. It just makes me chuckle, because we all used to have it, and you know, we all used to hear it, and you just can't do it anymore, because you're going to go for an early bath. And that sort of law change, although some of the almost non-contact free kicks we see at times are frustrating. Mm. It is, the laws are there to be able, these guys, to go and showcase their talents. But from a midfielder or defender's perspective, it's really frustrating that you can't go out there and be really aggressive from the first minute. Because you know, if you miss time of tackling one of these guys, and there's every chance that's going to happen with their ability, you're going for an early bath.
I tell you what, that's epitomised. If you've ever seen the Maradona documentary, which is fantastic, they just kick him left, right and centre for 90 minutes. And unfortunately, now, obviously, the game has evolved. I'm not sure if you would have got a game, Don, now, but there we are. You what else stood out from you from today's win?
I just thought City's class. I thought Wolves in the second half, in all honesty, carved out some brilliant chances. Jimenez missed an absolute sitter. Pedence, when he went 1v1 with the goalkeeper, he tried a lob, which was never really the right technique to try and pull off. But it still gives everyone hope then, the teams at the top of the league, that City are not the finished article. I think Craig's absolutely right. When you look at Man City, they need a presence. They need someone that can stand in that centre-half position. And then when the team sheets come out, because when the team sheets come out to me, Dan, it wasn't the most scariest Man City 11 I've ever seen. So it screamed of maybe his weakness at Mendy's side, weakness at Walker's side. The two centre-halves are trying to gel together. We know what they're going to be like going forward. But, you know, I think Guardiola's style, we're buying Ferran Torres. It looks like he's going to try and solve one or two issues at the back. But like Pep always tells us, they'll try and score more goals.
Dan, I just want to say something, that the result could have been different if maybe Mendy would have been sent off for he had a yellow card in the first half, and after he made a huge foul on the Traoré 10 minutes before the end of the game, where it was already 1-2. And it would have been maybe a different result if Mendy would have been sent off and City would have played 10 against 11. That's a rough decision. I have to accept it, but... it would have been interesting to see if the result would have been the same with 10 guys against 11, especially with all the defensive problems that City are facing.
Frank starts the season with his anti-Manchester City ways. That continues on Extra Time. Be sure to check that out over on our YouTube channel where the boys answer some of your tweets.
Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Meanwhile, AC Milan kicked off their campaign with a 2-0 victory over Bologna today. Matteo Bonetti joins us to take us through this. Matteo, not bad for a 38-year-old, eh? Zlatan with both goals.
And I can't believe that some people were saying this was a PR stunt back in January when Milan signed Ibrahimovic. The difference that Zlatan has made off the pitch, on the pitch, he's given this team a winning mentality, something that they haven't had really since the early part of last decade. The influence that he has, and maybe not even as a traditional leader, he's not someone that's going to pat you on the back, but you just see those death stares that he gives his teammates when they mess something up. He demands excellence, and he knows what it takes to win. His image at the club, obviously, he was there the last time they won the Scudetto, but coming back in what's supposed to be the twilight of his career, he's looking as crisp as ever. His on-the-pitch performances, his touch, his ability to generate the work ethic around him as well. I think it's been a brilliant signing, an expensive short-term rental, but one that has been absolutely worth it so far for Milan.
Yeah, he said after the game today, if he was 20, he would have scored four, so he just had to make do with two because of his age these days. What else stood out for you today from Milan, which, let's face it, a lot of excitement going into the start of this new season?
And rightfully so, there should be this excitement, Dan. 9 out of 12 wins since post-lockdown in Serie A. They play good aesthetic football. The passing is crisp. Obviously, the signing Sandro Tonali came on in the second half, along with the ex-Real Madrid player Brahim Diaz. But it's going to take some time to get Tonali in the starting lineup. Right now, as it is with the two holding midfielders, I don't know where Tonali is going to play when you have Frank Kessie and Ismael Benacer, who really became one of the best holding midfield duos in the entire league. The way that Milan, though, were passing the ball around, the quickness, the movement off the ball, this isn't something that we've seen from the Rossoneri in a very long time. And they finally, Dan, have the belief and the identity that even when they go down a goal, you just have a feeling that they're going to find a way to squeeze out a result. And I think that that sort of character and that sort of personality has been the biggest change with keeping Stefano Pioli the manager and bringing in a winner like Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Title contenders?
No. But top four for sure, and that's already a huge step. Let's not go ahead and get carried away with saying that they're going to challenge for the Scudetto. I think it's only Inter to be the anti-Juve who's going to push Juventus until the last match day. But for Milan, they haven't been to the Champions League in nearly a decade. So let's start first with going into the top four, going back into the Champions League, obviously all the money that that provides, but also the scouting and the ability to attract players that now look at Milan and they see a club that has a hard time getting out of the Europa League group stage. So that would already be a massive step up for them going back into the Champions League, a competition that they know very well, but not with this group of players.
Of course, they're challenging Juventus, always a daunting prospect, even more so from what we saw at the weekend. A very impressive start to Pirlo's tenureship.
Yeah, it was, and a bizarre appointment when it happened, surprising, but clearly Juventus knew that Pirlo would have been low risk, high reward, someone who knows the club inside out, not from a managerial perspective, but also the respect that he's already garnered from that dressing room. And it felt like Juventus were playing freely. The way that they were moving around with the ball, it felt like everything that Maurizio Sarri was supposed to bring last season, finally seeing that result, that high tempo, the high press, the good possession on the ball, the high line. And there were so many changes, Dan. This Juventus side that we saw over the weekend against Sampdoria was missing pretty much five starters. That was not the best starting 11 that we're going to see this season. Paulo Dybala, the MVP from last season, Matthijs de Ligt, Rodrigo Bentancur, Arthur from Barcelona, all those players were missing, and they're going to figure in this lineup. I think the best starting 11 this season for Juventus is better than what we saw in the last campaign, and that's scary for anyone else that's trying to challenge for the Scudetto, because 10 straight, they're the favorites until they prove otherwise.
Weston McKennie, given the highest marks by some, given his debut, what did you make of him, and is he guaranteed a start week in, week out?
No, he's actually not guaranteed to start, but it was a very good debut from Weston McKennie. No one was expecting him to start in the Italian media in this game. He came over from Schalke sort of the replacement for Blaise Matuidi, high-energy, box-to-box player that's going to break up play, that's going to intercept the passing lanes, but also a player that can get forward. And I actually liked the calm confidence that McKennie showed. He's not someone that's going to dazzle you with dribbling or passing. He just kept things simple, but he broke up so many plays in the midfield, Dan. And those characteristics that he has, he's the only player in the midfield unit that has that sort of defensive ability, the high energy. So Juventus really do need him. Now, is he a guaranteed starter? I'm not sure about that. He's definitely going to fight for one of those places in the midfield. Right now, I still think that the best midfield for Juve would probably have Arthur, Bentancur, and then one of Rabiot, McKennie, even Aaron Ramsey, who can play in a whole host of positions, who was brilliant yesterday. The best performance from Aaron Ramsey. But Weston McKennie definitely with a very positive debut.
Another positive debut. Kulusevski took his goal really well, didn't he?
Oh, amazing finish. It really was, and nothing surprising. That's what he was doing at Parma all of last season. And the thing that Juventus love about Kulusevski, other than his natural ability on the ball, his wand of the left foot, is his versatility. He said it himself, he can play central midfield, he can play as a second striker, as a winger. And the thing that I liked a lot about this strikerless formation for Pirlo is that there was no reference point. You saw that interchangeability, Kulusevski taking up so many different positions on the pitch. He is going to be an absolute danger. And I like the way that him and Ronaldo were combining. A brilliant signing, Dan.
Matteo Bonetti, thank you very much. Check out Matteo on the Serie Awesome podcast. The latest edition will drop on Wednesday. And we'll be back here tomorrow. Manchester United in Carabao Cup action. We'll be talking about that and a lot more.
Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at lectricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's lectricebikes.com.
What a weekend that was then. Artur Rintat joins us once again from Germany to take us through some of the big talking points. Obviously, Archie, from a US perspective, we kind of want to start with Borussia Dortmund because of the performance from Gio Reyna and him bagging his first Bundesliga goal. How much coverage has he in particular got in Germany over the last few days?
A lot. In fact, there's a whole article about him in Kicker magazine over here. Kicker is a twice a week football magazine focused. It does sport, but the large focus of it is football. And it's reviewing his rise to the top and including his contribution on Saturday night. And there was so much to unpick from that, whether it's just how happy he looks playing in a Borussia Dortmund shirt to begin with, how comfortable he looks on the ball as well. But in particular, the moment that I'd pick out was actually after the game. He's there with his fellow 17-year-old Jude Bellingham, and they they've got their arm around one another and they both spot each other on the big screen. And it was a lovely moment because they were both just bright, like broad smiles across their faces. And you can see how much he's enjoying this environment, playing with other young, quick attacking players. And Lucien Favre has been speaking very highly of him as well. Lucien Favre is known to be pretty reserved. And the in-joke with all the German journalists over here is that Lucien Favre says nothing in any press conferences. But Favre has been speaking highly of how intelligent he thinks Rainer is and all the qualities that he has as a player. So it's a very bright start to the season for Gio Reyna.
Archie, I don't know if we've ever really seen anything quite like this. That amount of talent on show at such a young age, it's box office stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a joke made in the German press that if you want to get into Borussia Dortmund's attacking lineup, then you have to be 20 or under. So it's incredible. I can't remember seeing anything like it. So many players going forward who really bring you to the edge of your seat. And I think it's... You've got a brilliant side in terms of to watch in Bayern Munich right now, but this Dortmund side are going to be a lot of fun to watch this season. I think that's almost one of the most encouraging things, is that this is all happening at the start of the season and it just fills you with so much promise for what's to come.
If this was a movie, I would suggest that Dortmund and their youngsters are very much the good guys, and then you'll have Bayern Munich very much on the dark side because they're the big bad bullies, aren't we? And we saw that against Schalke. This is a team who take no prisoners and will just keep going until they score as many goals as they can.
RIP your mentions from Bayern fans after
that.
Oh,
God, dear me. You should see it from United fans.
I have to say, though, this Bayern side, like, just from a football point of view, I was there in the stadium on Friday and was enjoying watching this team so much. The flair, the enjoyment that they're having right now. You saw it with that one move in the first half when Thomas Müller dummied and Serge Gnabry took a first-time touch past a Schalke defender on the volley it was. And then, of course, that Rabona from Robert Lewandowski. The fact that it didn't really prompt a reaction from Schalke shows you the state that Schalke have come into the season in and the pressure that there already is on them going into the second game of the season. But, of course, Bayern are going to have this tag of being the ruthless bad guys. But they've been wearing that for quite a long time now, and I think they relish it as well.
And where are they looking in the transfer market before it closes? Are we done, Archie, with both Dortmund and Munich?
With Dortmund, I think we are, but with Bayern, looks likely that Sergiño Dest is going to join the club from Ajax. I know that Hansi Flick has spoken about wanting another option in terms of on the wings. He thinks it might be a little too soon for Jamal Musiala, who became the fifth youngest Bundesliga scorer of all time when he scored Bayern's eighth against Schalke on Friday and became Bayern's youngest scorer in the Bundesliga of all time. So a really great prospect for them. He was back in action for Bayern's second team in the third division, though, over the weekend as well. So I wonder if Flick is having thoughts about is he ready or not, but all the vibes that Hansi Flick has been giving is that he would like another option there. But most importantly, having somebody for backup for Benjamin Pavard at right back, because Joshua Kimmich is somebody that he now sees as a central midfielder. I said the other day that Dest can play on the left flank. I think it is more on the right where he's more accustomed to. And other than that, maybe another option in the centre of midfield as well. But yeah, as for Dortmund, it looks like most of their business is done.
Jan was here at the weekend. He made a good point, I thought, when he went, all the teams that were rubbish last season are rubbish again this season, citing the fact that Schalke were terrible again. Josh Sargent's Werder Bremen as well failed to impress. And these two face off this weekend with a lot online so early on, only week two.
I'm heading to that. And that is looking like El Sakiko, because...
Oh, no. That's almost as bad as your Rebanovsky, whatever the hell you use on Friday.
Look, I saw somebody else call him Rabona Lewandowski, okay? Oh. I was just passing on the message of Twitter. But in all seriousness, when I spoke to Schalke coach David Wagner after the game on Friday, he didn't seem all that bothered by the manner of the defeat. I thought there was a distinct lack of fight from Schalke. They essentially chucked in the towel. And at this early stage in the season, I know this Bayern side are one of the best teams that we've seen in Germany, probably the best team we've seen in Germany since they last won the Champions League trophy in 2013. But for them not to change anything tactically and just to take that kind of defeat, I thought was a very worrying sign, particularly how most of the players just didn't seem that bothered. As for Werder Bremen, Jan's right, because the same softness that they were showing defensively reared its ugly head again against a Hertha side that didn't have to work all that hard to score four goals. Josh Sargent was the guilty party at the back post for the first goal. He let Peter Pekarik go. I think Bremen have more in them right now than Schalke. There's not as much pressure, I think, on Florian Kohfeldt, but my main concern is how both of these coaches are looking at their teams right now. There seem to be some rose-tinted glasses when actually these are two of the biggest clubs in German football who are in real trouble. And sure, Schalke aren't going to be playing Bayern every week, and Werder Bremen is going to be an easier game in that sense. But this is going to be the first time, in all likelihood, given the way that the corona rates are looking here, that Schalke are going to be playing a game in front of their fans since March. Schalke fans right now are furious at what is happening at the club. You saw the protests at the end of the season to do with Chairman Clemens Ternes. So now the question is, if the Schalke fans are there and if Schalke put in a performance as bad as it was against Bayern, then I think David Wagner could be in trouble. Jochen Schneider came out and was a lot stronger in his tone, saying it was unacceptable. Bastian Ochipka came out and said that it was a disgrace, the way that they performed. But I didn't see that quite the same urgency from David Wagner. Maybe he's trying to play it down for his own sake, but was not impressed at all by Schalke, apart from the opening 60 seconds.
Didn't somebody tweet out that Schalke looked a lot better in the opening 60 seconds than they did for the majority of last season? How did that age, Archie?
It's still true. Shame about the last 89 minutes. But
yeah. Oh, dear. Our German expert, Archie, thank you very much. just a reminder then, Schalke's game live on ESPN Plus this weekend, as is every single other game in the Bundesliga this season.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Let's focus on La Liga now. Just literally through the door after returning from San Sebastian after watching Real Madrid's opening game, which of course finished 0-0 against Real Sociedad. Sid Lowe is here. Sid, what a waste of time that trip was.
I'm so glad you said that as I just walked through the door after a 5-hour drive. I feel fully fulfilled having gone to see this 0-0 draw, yeah.
Sid, what's the reaction been like in Madrid to this, what was just a non-event almost?
Yeah, I think there's a sense that Real Madrid plays reasonably well, but the worrying thing, I think from a point of view of the reaction here, is that there's a sense that this has been seen before, that Madrid's failure to score goals, their inability to deliver the knockout blow, even when they're more or less in control in games, is concerning. Bear in mind, of course, that last season the second top scorer in the Real Madrid team was Sergio Ramos. Now, it is true that last year they got away with the fact that really and truly only Karim Benzema scored very significant amounts of goals, because 22 squad players scored last year. So somewhere along the line, at some point or other, it always felt like someone would get a goal. But there was still that sense there was a lot of games when he didn't kill games off. And last night was one of those. And of course, you also had the situation last night where Jovic was on the bench, yep, didn't come on. Borja Mayoral didn't come on. Mariano didn't come on. The three strikers didn't come on. Zidane said, look, I didn't want to change the formation because, of course, he had Karim Benzema on the pitch, and so he went for two very, very young wingers instead. He an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, of course, Arribas and Marvin were put on the pitch, and they didn't find a way through. And so I think there's a little bit of a doubt about whether Madrid had strength and depth in striking positions. That said, in their defence, I guess there was no Marco Asensio available, and there was no Eden Hazard available as well, and those two would probably make a big difference when they come back. But of course, those who are very opportunistic, Dan, which definitely isn't me and definitely isn't you, have pointed out that a certain Gareth Bale and James Rodriguez might have helped.
Yes. Where are they these days? What are they up to in their lives? Obviously, then there's the immediate reaction. Real Madrid need a striker. Who's around? Oh, look, Cavani's looking for a club. Is there anything to this?
I mean, look, I would be absolutely amazed. Look, I've learned over the years that in the transfer window, you never rule anything out. But Real Madrid have been very, very clear from the start of the transfer window. They've been clear to anyone who will listen, and they've been clear to Zidane. There aren't going to be signings. That this is a window based on consolidation and protecting them. They are not signing anyone. So I find it very difficult to believe, as I say, hold my hands up and say, I don't know if we're going to get a huge shock, but I find it very difficult to believe that they would spend significant money, because Cavani would cost a lot of money, on a very old striker who can only play for maybe a year or two at the very most, when there's absolutely no doubt that Karim Benzema is first-choice striker. So even if Cavani was to come, he's not going to be starting for Real Madrid.
Meanwhile, Sid, another chapter to that Luis Suarez book behind you. Atletico Madrid looks like his destination.
Yeah, Atletico were quite clear about this earlier in the transfer window, that they felt that it was very, very difficult to make this kind of deal happen. Of course, the way that you can make this happen, because the financial implications are absolutely huge, is twofold. One, of course, is to make Luis Suarez cheaper, and one way of doing that, of course, is for Suarez to deal with Barcelona, to get a reasonable payoff and to turn up as a free agent. And not only turn up as a free agent, but to turn up as someone who believes that he's already basically been paid for most of this year, in other words, would accept a lower salary from a club, in this case, Atletico Madrid. The other is to generate the kind of money to enable you to do this, and that would be done through the departure of Alvaro Morata. It looks like there's momentum building now. It looks like this is likely to happen. And I think it's a tremendously exciting prospect. One we talked about a few weeks ago, remember? The idea of Suarez and Simeone being together. And imagine the Suarez, Simeone and Diego Costa trio. Now, that's fighting talk.
That is definitely fighting talk. Sid, I wanted to talk about the reaction to Ricky Puig. Obviously, he was the one shining light, if there was any, under Kiki Setien, of course, coming in and doing well. How much... Is it true Ronald Koeman said, no, we don't want you, go out on loan for a year to gain experience?
Well, it's curious because Ronald Koeman said that it wasn't true, but then proceeded to point out that it was. What he, I think, was upset about was the way that it was presented in terms of the tone. He said, look, I didn't tell him I wasn't counting on him. I told him that he's a young player. Young players need to be playing. They need to be playing a lot of games. There's a huge amount of competition for his place. And I told him that because of that, there wouldn't be many opportunities this year. And because he's young and because he has a future at the club, and he didn't actually say these words, but beyond this season, the right thing to do is to look for some sort of short-term solution so that he's playing a lot of games. So yes, fundamentally, he's told Ricky Puig that, you know, you're not going to play this season. Now, there's a couple of reasons for it. One is fundamentally that there are very good players in front of him. The other, of course, is that Koeman has changed the formation from a 4-3-3, in which Ricky Puig's natural position would be as what's known as an interior in Spain. So one of those inside midfield positions either side of Busquets. And that's so he's moved from that to a 4-2-3-1, which means Ricky Puig has got one of two choices. One of the two deep midfielders, which really isn't his role, or behind the striker. Now, behind the striker is actually quite a nice role for him. It's probably a little further forward than he would like, but it would suit him very well. But of course, if you're playing behind the striker, see, that's where the problem comes, because Koeman in these two friendly games he's had so far has played either Antoine Griezmann or Lionel Messi there, and there's even been moments for Coutinho. Those are three players who, however good Ricky Puig is, those three players are ahead of him.
Before I let you go, Sid, how is Messi? What's going on? I feel like we haven't talked about him for a moment.
Well, in Spain, they have analysed and reanalysed and slowed down and sped up and fast-forwarded and zoomed in on the handshake that he gave to Ronald Koeman the other day during the friendly game. The two of them didn't really look at each other. And the amount of amateur psychology that's gone on around this has been absolutely off the scale. It's been kind of enjoyable in a completely crazy sort of way. He scored a couple of goals. In that sense, he's looked pretty good. But I just don't think we really know anything until the season kind of moves on into the first two or three weeks of competitive games. In fact, in a funny sort of way, you look at last season, you could say the season doesn't really get measured until they play very significant opposition in the Champions League, or until they play Atletico Madrid or Real Madrid or Sevilla or one of those really big teams in La Liga.
Sid Lowe, go and say hello to your family. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us. The latest edition, by the way, of the Gab and Jules podcast sees Mark Ogden as their special guest. You can listen to that now over on the website. Thank you very much to Sid, Matteo and Archie. For more from Frank, Craig and Don, be sure to stay tuned as Extra Time is next. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. Thank you, as always, for your tweets. Craig here, as is Frank, and Don with his kind of disco ball in the background. Don, what is it? Is it crystals, lights, reflecting off your German...
Oh, it's little chandelier.
Look at that.
Off the Germany shirt.
Chandelier, posh, real diamonds. What?
The guy, he still lives in the 80s.
Okay. Craig, should Klopp consider always playing Fabinho in the centre-back position and as a result giving Thiago more playing time in the midfield?
No, because, you know, I mean, they can do it, but ultimately they're going to need somebody that can break the play up in there. And so I think Fabinho will play most of his football in the middle of the park. That's not to say Thiago won't play in there as well. He can play further forward. So I don't see necessarily one dropping for the other. I think maybe against the weaker teams, we might see Liverpool without a real defensive midfielder in there. But against the better teams, I don't see Fabinho a fit not starting in the middle of the park.
What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, I agree. It would be a shame to not choose Fabinho. Fabinho has so much... tools in his pocket that he can use to help Liverpool offensively as well. So to put him at the back, of course he has been fantastic and he can serve the club very well. But that would be quite a shame to not use him in the middle of the park, as said Craig, to bring a plus offensively.
Don, is the number of penalties we've seen in the Premier League's first 2 weeks due to a lack of match mental physical sharpness?
I think that, and probably getting used to the new laws. Listening, just go back to the Victor Lindelof handball very quickly. I never thought that was a penalty in a million years. And even under the new laws and the new rules, you know, IFAB have come up with this ball strikes an arm when it's in an unnatural position. I mean, it's the most natural position I've ever seen a Premier League, you know, player do, because he's running with his arms. It's a natural movement. It hits his arm. The proximity was half a yard away as well. So that wasn't a penalty that sat well with me. So I think we're going to see some different decisions that we all probably need to get used to.
All the boys, I think it was Shaka and Stevie on the show, they thought it was a penalty, Don. They said that there was further enough distance away from Lindelof that it was a penalty.
What, half a yard? I mean, every ex-pro that I've spoke to or looked at their opinion on social media, I think the boys would be in the minority, because, you know, when the ball clipped off Victor Lindelof's hand, he was off RU, he was literally half a yard away, and he was only making a normal run in action. So I'm not sure how on earth you can try and call that as a deliberate penalty. It doesn't sit well with me, that one.
Did you not see what I tweeted about it, Don?
No, what'd you say?
Nothing. I couldn't give a toss about Twitter.
Listen, do you think that's a penalty?
No, I agree with you. I agree 100% with you. I think it was so harsh, it was scary. But in some sense, I can see why they didn't overturn it in VAR, because they don't really want to get involved in the decision because it did hit his hand. But I think we all know. I mean, you're right. If Victor Lindelof had been running with his arms locked into his side, would have been hammering them. So actually, here's what he does. He runs normally and the ball flicks up. I just think it was so harsh. And no, I didn't think it was a penalty at all.
I think we've got to be careful, because if we start going down the route of a ball hits a hand, it's an automatic penalty. If I'm on the angle and Frank's defending against me and I've got no chance of scoring, I've got no support, I am actually going to try and flick the ball off Frank's arm and then hope for a penalty and hope for a VAR decision. I think it's a very dangerous road to try and go down that one.
But hasn't we always been calling out?
We can carry on with the debate with De Bruyne's penalty today, where, of course, there is a tackle from Saïss and you can say it's a foul, but the penalty should be given if you consider that there is a one chance for De Bruyne to score a goal or to have a chance to score a goal. Do you think with De Bruyne kicking the ball away in the stands and then falling, will allow him, if Saïss doesn't tackle, to go to the goal and score? That's the main problem that referees have to answer. And for me, yes, it's a foul, but there is not a foul big enough to give a penalty. That's a problem that I have.
Frank, don't worry. Just edit that bit of nonsense out.
It's a foul, but not a penalty.
It's not a big enough foul.
Foul, but not a penalty. And I wish I had that answer. Remember, guys,
that our time, you had an indirect free kick possible in the penalty box.
Yeah, but you're now living in the 70s, Frank.
No, I don't sing, celebrate, and I have a disco ball in my house. No. It's just, yeah, maybe there was another time, but you have to consider everything. It's for, in Lindelof, penalty is the same.
A foul is a foul. You said it's a foul, it's a foul, it's a penalty.
No, a foul is not the foul. Because
of course it is. A foul is a foul. That's it. If you foul him in the box, it's a penalty.
So why the ref doesn't give a yellow card to Mendy in a foul on Traoré? Tell me why. If it's a foul, it's a foul. If it's a foul that you're doing on purpose, it's a yellow card. So
but
why the ref doesn't give a foul?
Not every foul is a yellow card. That's subjective. But every foul in the box is a penalty if it's a foul. Don't worry, Frank.
It's okay. It's just
I'll edit
so
it
you
out
consider
for you.
Now. If the ball goes to your hand, it's a penalty. So why do you debate on Lindelof?
No. Because it's not a penalty if the ball automatically strikes your hand. But if they say the hands, as Don explained, is in an unnatural position, which it wasn't because Lindelof was running, unless he runs with his hands at his side, I don't know where he has to put them. Mm. And the proximity of the attacker and him was half a yard or a yard at most. So anyway, I don't know.
Well,
you've confused me.
Frank, when you're running for your next bottle of wine, just have a little look at your hands. I bet they're sort of doing that little motion there.
Frank has wine brought to him. He doesn't
maybe.
Have to run anywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He
doesn't run. All the time he raises his hands when he clicks his fingers like that.
Then the butler comes.
Bring me.
Yeah, well check out the butler then. See if his hands are in a natural position.
Exactly. Don, do you think Pochettino will be the manager of Chelsea or Manchester United by the end of the season?
No, I don't. I think the next big one that's probably going to come to the Premier League, and it's only a matter of time, is probably Nagelsmann at Leipzig. I think he's probably on everyone's lips.
Where's
at the
he
moment.
Go?
Say again?
Where's he going to go?
I don't know at the minute. I mean, depends on how Ollie does. Listen, if Ollie bombs in the next four or five games, he's going to be under pressure, exactly the same as Frank. You know, these guys have been brought in to try and get closer to Man City and Liverpool and try and deliver some domestic trophies. So we'll have to wait and see over the next probably month on how Chelsea and Man United do.
Craig, have you ever seen a footballer transform their body to approach the game differently, like Deschambeau did in the golf, and did it pay off like Bryson?
Well, I've seen bodies change for the worse.
How is Stevie?
And it didn't pay off. But I have, I know some guys have gone down the road of going in the gym and really trying to bulk up, and it's they've had to go back the way, put it that way, because, you know, I've known some players that have went too much on bulk, particularly in the top half, and it's just affected their speed and their movement and stuff, and so they tailed it back. And of course, the strength conditioning is exactly that now. Strength conditioning, it's not muscle bulk, which is completely different. When you're talking about muscle bulk, you're looking at Bryson DeChambeau, and you're talking about bulk. That is different from strength conditioning. So, no, I don't. I mean, there's a few smaller players that, you know, you'd think, like Phil Foden, Christian Pulisic, maybe in some sense, Mason Mount at Chelsea. These sort of younger, smaller guys, there's an argument for them sort of bulking up a little bit. But as for the kind of bigger guys, I don't think it really works.
Don, would you spend any time in the gym when you were playing?
No, I couldn't stand being in the gym when I was playing until I got later on and I realised the benefits of it. And that was probably coming back from my ACL injury. But it never really suited me. I'd never had the physique. I was a cross-country runner, so trying to bulk up and eat 10,000 calories a day, I just couldn't physically do. So I don't think we'll ever see a footballer like DeChambeau. You know, it just, you know, weight training, and as Craig said, it has to be sport specific. There's no point in everyone trying to be like Traore, because you would lose different parts of your game. You wouldn't, right. You know, De Bruyne would be no good if he bulked up and become, you know, the size of Traore. He probably wouldn't have the same feet and the same running gait. So they're very few and far between, I would imagine.
Frank?
Yeah, I don't know. After my career, I started to work out, and if I knew, you know, I would have gone maybe more often during my career. I think to work on my upper body. I didn't want to touch my a little bit of pace that I had, you know, the anticipation that I could get, and maybe arriving before the strikers, before him into the ball. So that was a question that I had during my career, but didn't really want to move my body until the end of my career, because it was suiting me the way that I was. But when I see Van Dijk, when I see some others now in a modern football, maybe I would have more power to fight with the big British strikers, and it would have helped me out. But too late.
Do you know, Dan, I went to the gym more when I finished playing than when I played. And do you know why?
No.
Because nobody was telling me to go to the gym.
Right, so that makes sense.
And so when somebody's... No, but it's true. And when people are trying to, you know... Frank will tell you, the Italian guys that we played with, and also Ravanelli at Derby when I played with them, they came from a mindset. And I think it was Ravanelli and Vialli when they were strike partners at Juventus under Lippi, and that hugely successful Juventus team. They were fighting to get in the gym first every morning. I mean, the whole mindset is just completely different. And we'd never seen anything like it when those boys came over. We British guys, Frank knows, the British guys trained just as hard, but they didn't do the extra training.
Right.
Before training and after training in the gym. These guys were incredible athletes.
Well, if you follow Frank on Instagram, you can see some of his topless pictures from now. And
he's no
looking,
thanks.
Looking pretty good, ooh. Craig, I gotta say. Final question. Don. You. Who was the most intelligent player in footballing terms you guys have played with?
Oh, I think Johnny Barnes comes to mention at Liverpool. Yep. Dan, he was just so smart. You know, he's one of the best wingers that I think, you know, the country's ever seen. And then he's transformed himself when I was coming through into Liverpool's first team as being a central midfield player. Because he knew the game, he was smart, he knew different positions. He'd lost that little bit of speed. But for Barnsley, it was not a problem because he went into central midfield. You couldn't get the ball off him. Everything about him, his way to pass and his vision, his anticipation of where players are going to be was second to none, really.
Frank?
Well, definitely Zinedine Zidane. We are talking about the intelligence of football, I guess, and Zinedine was feeling everything. I mean, that's more than instinct. It's like you were born for that. You dedicated to that, and you made the right choice. And Zizou felt everything. I mean, you don't score two goals in a World Cup final like that. Mm. It's because you feel the thing. It's because you are the player that you are, and because you know that you have to do it, and you will do it. And it's why it's my choice.
Wow. Does Zidane think a foul in the box is a penalty?
Maybe.
Craig?
Not necessarily the best player that I play. I mean, bloody good player, but not necessarily the best player, but clever, I would say, Henrik Larsson. Because his understanding of his role and his movement and his understanding of the picture of what was around him and just knowing, anticipating the almost like a chess move, you know, one or two moves ahead. And that's why he played for as long and played for the clubs that he did and had the success that he did. And he was a nightmare for defenders because his movement and his game understanding was just absolutely fantastic.
Good stuff, boys. As always, thank you very much. Oh, Craig's just turned off already. That's it. He's gone. We'll be back here tomorrow for more. Be sure to join us. Until then, goodbye.